As noted, Britain sponsored an abolition of the Atlantic slave trade in 1808. Some trade still got through British blockades, but effectively, the big days of the slave trade were over. Britain abolished slavery in the colonies, in colonies like Jamaica, in 1833. The French Revolution of 1848 extended the attack on slavery in the French colonies. Slavery was clearly on the ropes. In some of the Latin American independence wars in the early 19th century, for example, in Mexico, the abolition of slavery was part of this process of revolt, although in the bigger slaveholding societies in Latin America, emancipation occurred noticeably later. Russia moved against serfdom in 1861, and a major emancipation there deserves comparison with abolition movements in other societies. The argument, obviously, was humanitarian in part based on a sense that Russian social conditions were lagging behind the standards of the civilized world, i.e. the West, and the embarrassment factor, once again, Russia needed to improve its standing by ridding itself of this awful institution. But a more pragmatic motive was clearly involved as well. The defeat of Russia in the Crimean War convinced many Russian leaders that the institution of serfdom was a drawback to Russian economic and military performance. Russia needed a more flexible labor supply, one that could move around at greater need as economic resources and demands required. The question of why this occurred has obviously bedeviled historians, and it is not easy to resolve it. We know one component. There is simply no doubt that the points already made, the emergence of new kinds of humanitarian arguments and effective political campaigns based on these arguments, involving the mobilization of public opinion, the use of petitions, educational campaigns, etc. We know that this was a factor. But, not surprisingly, many types of historians have been concerned that too much emphasis on humanitarianism might be oversimple, might lead to a conclusion that somehow the West had found a conscience in a period when, in other respects, the West was hardly pure as the driven snow. So other options have been sought, and they need to be explored as well. Additional argument number one. Slavery and harsh serfdom were uneconomical. On the whole, historians who have analyzed this argument, and it's a powerful argument, have concluded that it's probably incorrect, that this was not a major motive for abolition. Slavery was still very economically effective in producing sugar. This was the height of the use of slavery for cotton production. The crassest economic reasons for ending slavery probably don't apply, although larger considerations, like those, for example, in post-Crimean Russia, larger considerations about the need for greater labor mobility may still have operated, whether they were correct or not. Some historians have even demonstrated, looking at the American South, that you could even have applied slavery to the creation of factory industry, although this was not widely done. The notion that slavery died because it was economically ineffective is probably overall a non-starter, but it has been asserted. A more circuitous self-interest argument does also merit consideration. Some people have argued that some of the moral fervor devoted to attacks on slavery were designed to distract industrial workers in centers like Northern England from their own plight, get them excited about the conditions of distant peoples, get them outraged against distant planters, and maybe they'll forget about the fact that their own conditions were really pretty vile. Whether this was deliberately understood or not can be debated, but I suspect that one has to grant there was an element here in which people were directing morality against distant evils as a convenient means of ignoring evils under their own noses. The evils may have been greater. It is also important to note that the Atlantic system, the American system of slavery, was a particularly harsh and degrading form of slavery compared to slave situations earlier in world history, in the classical world or the Islamic Middle East, for example. So we don't want to forget that this was a real set of atrocities that were being addressed, that some of the propaganda about abuse of slaves was based on grim reality. But we don't have to rely on humanitarian sentiment alone. There may have been other factors. Another factor that must be considered is the concern about slave revolts or individual acts of defiance by individual slaves. The abolition of slavery, except in a few important single instances like Haiti, the abolition of slavery did not directly result solely from slave protest. But we want to remember that slaves were active in their own behalf, that former slaves like Frederick Douglass in the American North were eloquent in their attacks on this institution, and their voices and their protest or potential protest needed to be added to the mix as well. Finally, and actually I think this has been underdeveloped in the larger exploration of causes of the demise of slavery, we also must keep in mind the larger global demographic context. In the 19th century, population rates were increasing, although at different speeds, in most parts of the world. And this meant, and we'll see the application of this more fully in a moment, this meant that there were now alternatives to slavery in terms of sources of relatively available and, frankly, fairly cheap labor. You could call on the growing numbers of people who were crowding the countryside in Southern Europe, in Asia, elsewhere. You could call on these people to replace slave labor without necessarily losing much of a step in terms of economic profitability. Slavery, of course, did not die a painless death. Slave owners, in many cases, argued fervently for the importance of retaining the institution. They might appeal to property rights, and property rights loomed large in the thinking of political leaders in many places in the 19th century. But they might also, and this was an interesting connection between Southern American planters and Russian landlords, not a deliberate connection, just a coincidence of approach. They might also argue, in addition to property rights, that slavery was an essential institution to provide guidance and motivation to childlike peoples. Russian aristocrats, not the ones influenced by Western thinking, but the ones who were arguing for special Russian needs and conditions. Russian aristocrats might argue that the serfs could be charming people, but they were essentially children. And if they didn't have kindly landlords telling them what to do, organizing things for them, they would simply fall apart. Emancipation, in this sense, would be a disaster, not just to Russian society, but to the very people that the reformers wanted to assist. And obviously, American Southerners made much the same case. But the efforts to resist the tide of abolition lost. As noted, slavery and serfdom were abolished in the Western world and in territories under Western control by the middle of the 19th century. Slavery and serfdom were abolished in Russia and the United States in the 1860s. Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation was motivated certainly by some sense of the injustice of slavery, but also with a careful eye cocked to world opinion. Abolishing slavery in the secessionist states was a means of conciliating British and French public opinion, which was otherwise slightly inclined to sympathize with the South against the competitive industrial North. So this factor of opinion as well as morality was beginning to come into clear play. Slavery was attacked by European imperialists as they moved into Africa. Indeed, the argument that imperialism was essential to counter what was in fact a growing use of slavery in the 19th century African economy was one of the big arguments, one of the big humanitarian white man's burden arguments for imperialism. Wasn't the main reason the imperialists went in, but they really did work against slavery once they seized the reins of government in Africa. The abolition of slavery extended to additional parts of Latin America. Later in the 19th century, The abolition of slavery in Brazil in 1882 was a huge move. And again, Brazilian reformers by this point were picking up the twin arguments of humanitarian injustice and the sense that civilized world opinion was now hostile to this institution and hostile to societies that didn't get on the bandwagon appropriately. Slavery was abolished also in the later 19th century in places like Cuba. And now, finally, the anti-slavery forces began to attack the other stronghold of slavery in parts of the Middle East. And efforts to persuade local Middle Eastern rulers to renounce slavery extended from the later 19th into the early 20th century. By, say, 1923, the formal legal institution of slavery was effectively ended. And this, as noted, was a huge historic change. The abolition of serfdom or serf-like conditions was a little less systematic, but here too there were major gains. Serfdom was abolished in other parts of Eastern Europe, for example, in the later 1860s in places like Romania, in the wake of Russian reforms. So this was a huge movement. It derived from complicated causes, but it represents a major change in global conditions in the 19th century, and a major change in one of the staples of world history up to that point. What were the consequences? I think there are four categories here that deserve attention, and I'll start with the most immediate and work to the more general. First, obviously, specific emancipations, although they might derive from similar causes, actually had very different solutions to the problem of what would happen after slavery. When slavery was abolished in Jamaica, for example, in 1833, the abolitionists who had been extremely hostile to slavery turned out not to have paid very much attention to what would happen to the slaves once the institution was ended. Their moral fervor was very clear when it directed against something, more diffuse and ineffective when it came to, well, what's going to come next. Way stations were established that provided a period of years in which Jamaican slaves could still be bound, for example, to apprenticeships. Only gradually did full abolition occur. Russian emancipation in the early 1860s, where serfdom was concerned, was considerably more generous than American abolition. Only in a very few regions were American slaves directly given land after the abolition of slavery, whereas in Russia, a complicated formula was designed to let peasants have the access to most land while still preserving the aristocracy as a class. So peasants got a good bit of the land, although they deeply resented the fact that they didn't get all of it. The landlords kept some, and they viewed this sum as including the more productive. They did get the land, but they were required to pay redemption payments to help provide financial means that would preserve the aristocracy, even in serfdom's absence. And they were tied to their village, at least to some extent, until these redemption payments were satisfied. This was, again, in terms of strict economics, a more generous solution than that adopted in the United States. But because Russian serfs were in the majority, because restrictions seemed particularly annoying, precisely because so much had been gained, it was as if half a loaf had been achieved, but the rest of the loaf was still absent. Russian emancipation, ironically, triggered a recurrent series of peasant protests against their remaining obligations, against their landlords, against the redemption system, a series of peasant protests that would continue to crescendo into the 20th century, feeding the Russian Revolution of 1905 and then feeding as well the Great Russian Revolution of 1917. Conditions in the United States, where African-American ex-slaves were treated less generously, but were smaller in number and were subjected to a number of vigorous racist attacks. The aftermath here was different, not necessarily healthier in terms of the society as a whole, but less conducive directly to significant social protest. So, point one, the abolition of slavery and serfdom had varied effects in terms of what happened to the former slaves and serfs, in terms of political consequences, and one has here to go on something of a case-by-case basis. It's also been argued in the case of American slavery that another aftermath of slavery was an increase of racism. Now that people of color could not be subjected to servitude directly in law, many people who had become accustomed to their superiority over people of color now manifested their claims and their uncertainties in increasingly overt racism. This phenomenon was noticeably more marked in the United States than in Latin America. Latin American racism was less virulent. Among other things, Latin Americans differed from citizens of the United States in not necessarily regarding someone who had some colored blood in their background as clearly African. Gradations were smoother. But it has also been noted, although overt racism was and is less of a factor in Latin American society where slavery had previously existed, nevertheless, the people of darkest color tend to be lowest on the economic totem pole. Some degree of prejudice and identification obviously persisted here, too, in the aftermath of slavery. Impact number two. Not surprisingly, although not pleasantly, many societies saw efforts to revive conditions that had some similarity to slavery, even though they weren't quite as bad in terms of strict legal onus. In Brazil, for example, for a while, orphans were deliberately recruited into the labor force without any choice of their own, treated effectively as slaves, at least until they became adult. In the Belgian Congo, under King Leopold, while slavery was abolished, African workers were forced into mine work on pain of physical mutilation, a situation whose differences from slavery, frankly, are too subtle for anyone clearly to discern. Slave-like conditions, or at least conditions that evoke slavery, might also result from harsh sharecropping systems, where people, although legally free, could work the land only if they agreed to heavy taxation in kind as a result of their tenure. And in this system, it often became very difficult to get out from under the burdens to the actual landowners. Or in many factories in Mexico, as well as in the United States, conditions of indebtedness were used effectively to tie workers to their owners. That is, workers had to shop in company stores, they piled up big debts, they were not legally free to leave their employ until these debts were resolved, but wages were too low really to permit this. Even in more recent times, semi-slavery has been produced, for example, in some of the Pacific Islands under United States control, where textile companies recruit labor from Asia, seize the passports of the workers and tell them if they don't work well, they will automatically be shipped home because they have no voice over their own conditions. Again, a familiar enough point. Slavery was gone, but what we could, I think, legitimately regard as semi-slavery cropped up in all sorts of different places. Impact number three, particularly impact of the abolition of slavery in the Americas. With slavery gone, labor needs now had to be satisfied by looking for new streams of immigration. One source in the later 19th century involved Southern and Eastern Europe, where large numbers of people from Spain, Italy, Poland, etc., came to the Americas, came to places like Brazil and Argentina, significantly adding to ethnic diversity, contributing relatively cheap wage labor, at least keeping the price of wages down because of their sheer numbers. Even more interesting, as a response to the abolition of slavery, was the new flood of emigration out of parts of Asia, from the Philippines, from China, from Japan, a bit later from Korea, and also from India. huge numbers of workers coming to places like the Pacific coast of Latin America, coming to the Caribbean, coming to other parts of Southeast Asia itself, often in conditions of indentured servitude, i.e., contracts would be signed for 5 or 7 years, during which the laborer was obligated to perform his or her tasks. This was not slavery. Some of these people later achieved freedom and could actually make significant economic headway. But a really interesting extension of the abolition of slavery into new worldwide patterns of labor organization and migration streams, a very important development in the later 19th century that would continue, obviously, to resonate in the 20th. Finally, final consequence, the kind of moral outrage, the kind of world opinion that had been mobilized against slavery didn't end with the abolition of slavery itself. In the later 19th century, for example, some of the same kinds of moral outrage, petitions, education campaigns, etc., were directed at new evils, such as the exploitation, the brutal exploitation of workers in the Belgian Congo, a major organization devoted to this cause, or to the phenomenon of white slavery, the notion that large numbers of American and European women were being sold into prostitution in places like Latin America. The fear, by the way, was exaggerated, although there was some reality to it, but the campaign was intriguing. The point is here, by the end of the 19th century, building on the effective experience of the anti-slavery crusade, a new kind of world opinion with organizations to back it, was available that could be applied to other kinds of abuse or other situations in which injustice could be perceived. The London Anti-Slavery Society, the largest, the oldest international NGO anywhere in the world, continued its operations, as it does still today, but now directed toward other forms of labor abuse. And there's really a direct connection between the kind of world opinion that had formed against slavery and more recent organizations like Amnesty International that seek to use world opinion against other abuses of human rights. This consequence of great importance for the 19th, but also the 20th century, is the final legacy of this really interesting moment in the history of the world in the long 19th century.
Lecture 26, Modernization and Nationalisms.
Our discussion today is frankly a bit of yin and yang. We're going to talk about new divisions in world history during the long 19th century, but we're also going to talk a little bit tentatively about some common trends that cut across these divisions. And then, as the third segment, we're going to talk about the spread of nationalism, which was both a common trend and a source of division. Again, bit of yin, bit of yang. Divisions, in some senses, are pretty obvious. We've already noted the important division that opened up in the long 19th century between societies that industrialized, almost exclusively in the West until the very end of the period, and the large number of societies that were still largely agricultural, that became increasingly peripheral as their economies were bent to service to the industrial zone. A few economies hovered a bit in between. Russia and Japan particularly are noteworthy for launching an early industrial process before 1914, but a big division that, as we discussed earlier in comparing the United States and Mexico, had big implications as well for increasing differentials in standards of living. But the developed, less developed division, a 20th century concept, which however can be applied to the 19th, is not the only division going. There's also the obvious division between societies held as colonies with the spread of imperialism and societies that remained at least technically free. It was obviously interesting that in a century that saw the extension of European imperial controls over Africa and Oceania, Latin America, politically at least, gained independence for the most part. We've noted before, but it deserves emphasis, the interesting comparison between China and India. India held as a colony, China increasingly subject to European territorial seizures and exploitation, but remaining technically independent. As noted before, some historians have argued that in this trade-off, China actually had the worse of it. It would have been better to have been a colony. But even among colonies, differences loom. India, held for a long time by the British, though certainly suffering from British imperial control, fared better under imperialism in the long 19th century than Africa did. Africa was seized later. Its territories were divided among competing European states who raced each other to some extent to see who could exploit what the fastest. And probably there was greater racism applied to African subjects than to Indian, although racism could be involved there as well. Divisions obviously run deep in the long 19th century. And in the two subsequent discussions, we're going to focus on particular patterns that need to be held up against more general developments. But we've also argued, and here we come to at least feeble effort to establish some common themes, we've also argued that along with differential economic change, differential imperialism, came some increasing realization of the need for certain kinds of reforms. And without oversimplifying the process, this realization normally included some sense that at least certain aspects of what the West had developed would need to be copied, possibly modified, possibly limited, but copied if societies were to gain enough strength to establish or retain independence in a world increasingly dominated by European political control and by the control of the industrial zone. Now, there is a theory called modernization that might begin to be applied to the 19th century, and because it's a theory that has widespread hold in our thinking, even though it is disputed by scholars, I actually believe it's important to trot this theory out, examine it, and then talk about how it might, in a very limited fashion, apply to the 19th century itself. Modernization theory, which was the brainchild of American sociologists back in the 1950s, though it owes something to earlier German work by people like Max Weber, modernization theory fundamentally argues that as societies realize the directions of industrial, modern political states, headed initially by the West, they will begin to change a number of aspects of social activity in parallel directions. Modernization theory argues then, first, that societies will increasingly head in the same basic directions, and that there will be connections between developments, say, in intellectual life, in family life, in political life, and so on. Modernization, first of all, argues that increasingly societies will become or will try to become industrial. Economic modernization really means industrialization, catching up to the latest technology, moving increasingly toward an emphasis on manufacturing or other high-tech sectors as opposed to agriculture. This is a fairly simple concept. Modernization, however, extends beyond the economy to argue that there is a phenomenon that we could call political modernization, in which governments will try to take on some new functions, for example, mass education, in which they will possibly shed some older functions, for example, protection of any particular religion. Political modernization will involve the creation of larger bureaucracies, specifically trained to their function and chosen at least to some extent by merit rather than privilege or kinship ties alone. Political modernization then argues for the creation of a somewhat new kind of state whose operation will parallel the modernization of the economy. Modernization theory might be applied to intellectual life. As a society modernizes its culture, it will, for example, increasingly emphasize science.